Jack Shane Metal Drum Rambling
So first of all, Geshla would like to greet all of you, to say welcome to all of you that have come here today, monastics and lay people alike. The reason that Geshe Rabge is here with us today is that this opportunity to come here to Italy came up. This is his first visit to Italy. And there was an idea, a suggestion that was made that he would be taking over the review sessions with Rinpoche. So he accepted the invitation and he came along with Kyabji Ling Rinpoche. So Geshla's idea for this session is to review what Kyabji Rinpoche said today. Since he doesn't have a lot of experience in teaching Westerners, he hasn't taught Westerners before, he thought that his idea is to review what Kyabji Rinpoche said today, to expand on that, to make a few points clear, to speak of the essential points that Rinpoche spoke of today, and then also to do a half an hour of Q&A. So if you guys have any questions, we'll get the time to bring them up and we can have a discussion.
The question is to the Dumas,
So before we get into the crux of it, we will start with recitation of the verse for refuge and bodhicitta in your prayer books. It is found in page number 23. And we're going to recite it three times. The idea is that the first two lines in this verse, the one that says Sangye Chütam Tsogye Chonam La, are the two verses in which we, or two lines in which we go for refuge. So that in terms of whatever we practice, for it to become a Buddhist practice, a Dhamma practice, it needs to be combined with going for refuge. The last two lines in this verse, the one that say, if you look at page 23, is involved with developing bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, so that using that, whatever thing we take up, whatever Dhamma practice we take up, including listening to the teachings, it in itself will become a Mahayana Dhamma. So, that being in case, we're going to recite it three times.
Chodan Tsongye Chonam La Chancho Badu Dani Kyap Su Chi Nage Chunye Gipe Sonam Gi Drola Penchia Sangye Drupa Shu Chodan Tsongye Chonam La Chancho Badu Dani Kyap Su Chi Nage chunye gipe sonam gi drola penchie sangye drupa shu Chodan songye chonam la chancho badu dani kyap su chi Nage chunye gipe sonam gi drola penchie sangye drupa shu
Yesterday, Kyabje Lenpoche started off the teaching with reciting a couple of verses from the condensed version of the Sess of the Path of Enlightenment. A text that is called Songs of Experience. And this couple of verses that Rinpoche recited, verses 13 and 14, begin with, "This life of leisure is even more precious than a wish-granting jewel." So these couple of verses condense the essential teachings of the states of the path of beings of the three scopes. As such, they condense all the teachings. So then, looking at the steps of the path as practiced also by the past lamas, the lamas of the past, and also explained by the great lamas of the past, they were explained as the steps of the path of beings from the three scopes that proceed to the state of Buddhahood, to the state of enlightenment. So then, in taking it up, our thought, our intention should be such that we think that I am going to progress through the steps of the path of those of the three scopes, so that it depends upon that I will attain the state of a Buddha. Without that thought, without that intention, there is a danger that our attitude would be a small scope attitude, would be limited only to that. Or without the intention, thinking that my intention is to become a Buddha, to attend the state of omniscience, there is a danger that our attitude would be a Hinayana attitude, in that we would be aiming at liberation alone in developing the determination to emerge from cyclic existence. And that being the case, a thought, a motivation should be such that we think that I am going to progress through the steps of the path of being through the three scopes, and I'm going to do it in sequence, in the right order, so that in depends upon that, I will be able to attain the state of the Buddha, the state of the Buddha. So Lama Tsongkhapa's songs of experience in explaining in verse number 13 that this life of pleasure is even more precious than wish-granting jewel, it uses an analogy to in which we can reflect upon the good working basis, this good body that we have at the moment. It says that it is even more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. So thinking about the analogy of a wish-fulfilling jewel, which is something that, of course, we don't come across, we don't find something like that now, it still illustrates that if we extract the essence of this good working basis, this good physical support that we have now, we can get something that is even more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. So a wish-fulfilling jewel is said to be that precious gem that will have the ability to grant you whatever you wish for, whatever you seek in this life, money, possessions, and so forth. But it is limited to this lifetime only. It cannot grant you things that are beyond that. So then, thinking of the three essences that can be extracted on the basis of this working basis that we have now. We have the smallest one, or the lesser one, the medium one, and the great one. A wish-granting jewel will not even be able to give us the least of the essence, the essences that we can extract from this human body, in a sense that the least would be to attain a higher state of rebirth as a human being or as a god in a next lifetime, to be born again in a pleasurable state of existence. Even if we had a wish-granting jewel, there would be no way that we'd be able to get that on that basis. Now, it is very likely that you guys are familiar with the sets of the path of practitioners, of beings of the three scopes, but in case there are some new people here with us today, or newer to this material, Geshe-la wanted to just revise briefly the steps of the path of those of the three scopes. So we'll begin with, first of all, making sure that we know that any of those beings, any of those beings accepts the existence of future lifetimes. No, this is what we accept within the Buddhist tradition. So on the basis of accepting, trusting that future lifetimes exist, a practitioner that is a small scope practitioner would like to attain, would wish to attain a high state of rebirth as a human being or as a god in a pleasurable state of existence in their next lifetime. In thinking of the suffering that exists in miserable states of existence, the hell realms, the hungry ghost, the animal realms, and finding those sufferings to be totally unbearable, that person would wish not to be born in those states of existence and to be born in a comfortable or pleasurable state of existence in the next lifetime. But aspiring to be born in that pleasurable state of existence alone is not enough. One also needs to create the causes for being born in a comfortable or a pleasant state of existence in the lifetime, in the next lifetime. And the cause for that primarily is guarding pure ethical discipline. This is to say, developing the ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 non-virtues. Now, if we develop the ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 known virtuous actions, it is guaranteed that we will obtain a pleasant rebirth, a good support as a human being or a deity in our next lifetime. It's just like if you need to travel somewhere else overseas, if you have a flight ticket, it is guaranteed, it is certain that you can do it. That's your flight ticket, in a sense, it is your passage to this journey. In a similar way, guarding the ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 known virtues is what guarantees, what makes it certain for you that you will attain a good basis in your next lifetime. Now, the guarding of ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 known virtuous actions is found not only for the small scope, but it exists also for those of the medium scope and also for those of the great scope. However, there is a difference in the way that those beings of the three scopes guard that ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 known virtuous actions. So, to illustrate that, consider the action of killing, which is a non-virtue. If one should kill, and this is a non-virtue, the result of that would be taking a rebirth in a miserable state of existence, in a hellish state of existence as an animal, as a hungry ghost, and there would be great suffering involved with that state of existence. So a person guarding ethical discipline would think that I need to guard my ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 wrong virtuous actions in order to avoid such a miserable rebirth for myself. No, so that would be the concern. The concern would be they themselves avoiding the suffering of miserable state of existence. Now, the simple act of non-killing does not constitute guarding ethical discipline that abstains from non-virtues such as killing. In that, when you consider, for example, a cow or a bull, or you consider an ant, it's not that they're actively involved with the killing of many. So even though they're not involved in the killing of others, you wouldn't say that therefore they guard ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 non-virtues or that abstains from killing. So in order for it to account for guarding ethical discipline that abstains from killing, one needs to recognize that killing others is an action that is harmful to others. On that basis, one should think, I will accrue a negative action, and that will be a fault on my account, in a sense that there would be something that would be damaging to me. Now, in terms of the action of killing, which is a non-virtuous, it produces a negative effect. But the negative effect and the extent of the negative effect will be determined by different factors, such as, for example, the preliminary stage for the performance of an action, in terms of the extent of the affliction that is involved in motivating oneself to kill. So if the affliction, if the disturbing emotion would be very strong, it would become, the preparatory section would also become very strong, and that will influence the result. Also, there is the actual performance part of the action, and there's the conclusion of that action. So if those three parts are complete and in a very strong way, it will bring about a miserable state of existence in a hellish state of existence. If one of those three components is missing, or there is a difference in the degree or the strength of those parts, one could take a rebirth as an animal or as a yidak. Right, so in general, we would say that such an action is a negative action. It produces such a rebirth, but it is of different extents according to the strength. So then when we consider the different types of the action of killing that are created, as there's a great variety, it could occur in different ways. Like, for example, you might be killing another human being, or you might be killing another animal. It might be for a certain purpose, like, for example, in thinking of the houses that we live in. Now, there are insects in that houses, or you could say that other types of animals. If you just happen to be building a house or to perform some, you know, if you're working in a certain trade and along the way you're killing living beings or insects and so forth that live in that place, then of course you will also be accruing some action of killing on that account. Also, the type of attitude that one carries into that action plays a role in the degree of that action. Like, for example, if you're being negligent, that would also determine. And also the degree or the strength of the action of killing could be determined in terms of the state of mind that is present. Like, for example, you might have a killing motivated by anger, a strong anger. It might be also the case that you kill when anger is not present. Like, for example, you're working somewhere or you're standing somewhere and there are insects under the mat and you happen to be squashing it without knowing it. So it is said that in such cases, there are no negativities. Particularly when you look at how it is explained from the point of view of the Vinaya and there are certain rules that were stipulated for gelongs, for bhikshus, for fully ordained ones. It is said that if, for example, one of the possessions of a gelong, a bhikshu, is a strainer, and that when one drinks water, the water should be, you should put first of all the water through a strainer in order to make sure that insects are not caught in the process of drinking water. So, nowadays, of course, there are also other living beings that cannot be seen by the naked eye. A Buddha with their omniscient wisdom, kind of with their pure wisdom, pure sight, of course, could see such living beings. But in an ordinary way, one would not be able to see such living beings that are so minute. So it is said that even if you drink water like that, you do not accrue negativity on that account. So then, in terms of the presentation of negative actions, we will look at that later on, but in general, we speak of negative actions of body, speech, and mind, physical, verbal, and mental negative activities. So when you look at the stipulated rules for monastics, for fully ordained ones, or for novices, for gelongs, and for getsels, those rules were made in referring to physical and verbal actions that one needs to abstain from. So one needs to guard against, or one needs to abstain from physical or verbal actions. There are no rules that were stipulated for the mind. After all, it is not possible to really stop those mental activities, those thoughts that are involved with those negative actions. And therefore, those stipulated rules were aiming at physical actions and verbal actions. Stopping those physical and verbal actions is easier in a sense that you might have a thought that you need to tell a lie in a certain, in a certain situation, but it is easy to restrain your speech from doing that. So this is important to understand. Now, when also speaking about our attitude in terms of Dhamma practice, and the attitude shouldn't be concerned with this lifetime, it doesn't mean to say that there should be no benefit whatsoever, or no help whatsoever in terms of this lifetime. First of all, it could be the case that there's some Dhamma practice that you do that will bring about benefit in future lifetimes, and just as well, incidentally, it will improve this lifetime, it will give you a benefit in this lifetime. So it is also important to understand that while one's attitude shouldn't be concerned with what you get from your practice in this life, it doesn't mean to say that you ought to get no benefit whatsoever in this lifetime from your Dhamma practice. You could also do things that are beneficial for this life.
Nel praticare in questo modo i benefici immediati a breve termine di questa vita avvengono di per sé.
So then in terms of guarding the ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 non-virtues, we can see that not only it is beneficial for future lifetimes, it is also beneficial in terms of this lifetime. In that, if you think of, for example, someone in a certain position, you know, regardless of whether they are a Buddhist or non-Buddhist, whether they're practicing Buddhism or not practicing Buddhism, regardless of the religion or the tradition that they practice, they can be in a position of being a manager or a politician. If they guard the actions well, if they have an ethical conduct, they will be well appreciated, they will be well liked by their peers, by other people. People will respect them, people will think that they're good people, and there's certainly a benefit that they will get in this lifetime from such an ethical behavior. So that being said, we can say that the guarding of ethical discipline is not only limited to next lifetime. So then we spoke of guarding ethical discipline as being the basic cause for attaining a human rebirth or a higher state of rebirth in one next lifetime, but that alone is not enough. One also needs to provide it with excellent conditions, with good conditions to attain a state of an excellent rebirth as a human being. Not just being a human being, but an excellent rebirth of a human being. So in order to do that, we have the practice of the six perfections, such as generosity, that is augmenting the guarding of ethical discipline. So the practice of generosity and giving contributes to having an access to food and drinks and those things that we survive upon. And we can think of a situation where if there's no food, if there are no things for us to drink, we'll not be able to survive, let alone to practice the Dharma. Our daily survival will be jeopardized. So then generosity is needed. On top of that, there is patience and ethical discipline. All of these are conditions that contribute to an excellent rebirth as a human being. But also, on top of that, when we think of our goal, we want to have a succession of good rebirths, a succession of life, so that in all those successions of life, we will meet again with the teachings, we will meet again with teachers that will teach us the Dharma, so that on that basis we'll still be able to continue our progression along the stages of the path that lead to Buddhahood. So in order to do that, we have the linking it up with stainless aspirational prayers. So making such dedications, such aspirations, also ensures that in our lifetimes we are connected with the Buddha's teachings. So then, if we guard pure ethical discipline, if we supplement it with the practice of the six perfections, such as generosity, and we connect it up with stainless aspirational prayers, then we will progress along the steps of the path that proceed to Buddhahood. In questo modo. Per cui se continuiamo anche in questa vita a fare in questo modo,
che piano piano questo ci porterà fino all'ottenimento dell'illuminazione.
No,
so in that way, Geshe-la has briefly spoken about the steps of the path of that I share with practitioners of the small scope, in that they take up guarding of ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 non-virtues. And on top of that, in order to create those conditions for an excellent rebirth as human being, you have the practice of the 6 perfections and the linking it up with Stennis' aspirational prayers at the end. So then, in looking at the steps of the path of those of the medium scope, we think that even if we secure a rebirth in a pleasant state of existence, in a pleasurable state of existence, it's not that we have attained a state of lasting happiness. After all, even if we attain a good state of rebirth in the next lifetime, should we still act in a way that is non-virtuous, if we still perform non-virtuous actions, we'll again fall into miserable states of existence. Not only there is still a danger of falling into a miserable state of existence in the next lifetime, we can also recognize that in this lifetime we do not have freedom, in that without intending to be born, we are born. Without intending to get sick, we get sick. Without intending to age, we do age. And without intending to die, we end up dying, because we have no control whatsoever over that process. So then we can recognize that even if we are born in a pleasant state of existence, it is just involved with weariness, in a state that we have no control, and there is still a danger of ending up in miserable states of existence.
Vogliamo delle cose che non avvengono, non vogliamo delle cose che avvengono. Tutta la situazione dell'esistenza è una mancanza totale di libertà, e questo avviene da tempo senza inizio. Se ci pensassimo bene, questo ci porterebbe un grande... dovremmo essere veramente stanchi di essere in una situazione di questo tipo. No.
Se non danno due ragioni, vedete, cordia di niente.
And therefore we have no control whatsoever in samsara. So that when we think of having no control in samsara, no control over the suffering that we experience, we then come to wonder whether we can put a stop to that. And if there is a way to put a stop to the suffering and a state of not having control in samsara, we have to do it. So in order to do that, we can cast our mind back to one of the verses that Kabjo Rinpoche mentioned yesterday. He mentioned a verse that is taken from Nagarjuna's precious garland, the Ratnavali, in which Nagarjuna said, so long as one conceives of the aggregates, for that long one will conceive of the I. And so long as one conceives of the I, one will perform actions and again take a rebirth. So then, looking at the first couple of lines, so long as one conceives of the aggregate, one will conceive of the I. That refers to ignorance of grasping at the self. Now we can state that in different ways, grasping at the self, grasping at I, ignorance of grasping at inherent existence and so forth. So we need to look at the notion of I that we have. So we are persons and we are imputed, it depends upon the basis of imputation, which are the aggregates. And this is what we take up in our practice of the medium scope. This is actually the main thing, the main point that we get at when we practice the path of those of the medium scope, to recognize the notion of I that we have, the grasping at I, in thinking that, for example, I want to be happy, I do not want to suffer. So we need to look at the notion of I and to recognize, to look into what is that I, who is me or what is me. We need to identify the I and me, and also to identify that grasping at a self, grasping at I. And on that basis of grasping at I, afflictive states of mind arise. We have anger, attachment, and other afflictions that arise on that basis. And motivated by anger, attachment, and other afflictive states of mind, we perform a variety of actions. We accumulate karma on that basis. So our goal is, or the main goal is, to recognize that notion of I, the grasping of I, ignorance of grasping at the self, in order to undo it. So then, looking at how we use language, we say that, for example, I go, or that person is going, they are going. And we use such conventions, it depends upon, for example, in the case of walking, there is a certain motion that is carried, right? Someone is walking. So we then label, I'm walking, or they're walking, it depends on that motion, on that activity. Or, for example, we say, I'm sick. This is that I'm in pain. So we can say that it depends upon a sensation that is a painful sensation. We can also refer to someone that is tall. You know, the person is tall or short. It depends upon their body. So in such way, we label, we designate certain things. It depends upon something else. So in the action of walking, for example, the thing that is in motion is the body, the form aggregate or the body. It depends upon that, we designate walking. So then, or for example, we can designate I or me or they, someone else. It depends upon seeing the body, seeing the form. Like, for example, it depends upon seeing the body, we can seeing the face, my face, we can think this is I, this is me. So we can designate such things, it depends upon the body, it depends upon form. However, if you look within the form, if you look within the aggregates, you will not be able to find what you're looking for. In a sense that when we look at the aggregates, we'll not be able to find that I within the aggregates. So through that we get to see that I or me do not exist from my own side. I do not exist from my own side. So this is there is a great benefit that you draw from thinking about it in this way. So we also, in relation to that, sometimes speak of dependent origination, dependent arising, and there's a lot of explanation that is given with respect to that, and that explanation can be given in a very impressive way, very extensive way. But if it's just limited to an impressive explanation without really getting it, there's not a lot of benefit. The benefit that you get from looking into that situation is through understanding that you do not exist from your own side. And when you do have that notion that there is I or me that exists from my own side, the commensurate with the strength of that notion, you'll have a strong degree of anger or attachment that will arise. And we can see that we do have different attitudes. Like, for example, some people will be able to think only of themselves. Some people would be able to not only think of themselves, but also to think of others around them, to care for others around them. So commensurate with that strong degree of grasping at I, for example, to the degree in which we can only think of ourselves, what can I get out of a situation, or what benefit I can get from my situation, commensurate with that, we will have a certain degree, certain strength of attachment or anger. So we can certainly see the degree of our afflictive states of mind on the basis of our grasping at a self as if we exist from our own side. So our mind can become at ease once we see that we do not exist from our own side. And in relation to that, you know, as now we have a thriving technology of making movies and TV series and so forth, Geshe said that when he looks at the recent developments in the entertainment industry in India, the movies or the TV series that one can make nowadays, there's, for example, a movie or a series that was made on the 12 great deeds of the Buddha, right? The 12 deeds of the Buddha, describing the life of the Buddha. So in one of those scenes or episodes, there was a description of an event that occurred after the Buddha attained the state of enlightenment, and it was dwelling together, residing together with a community of monks, and you know, there were dwellings all around. And one day, a villager came to see the Buddha. His wife was dying, and he wanted to invite the Buddha, to ask the Buddha to come along and see his dying wife. So the Buddha joined that person and went to see his wife, and the Buddha sat down and started to recite the Heart Sutra. Right, so there is no eye, no ears, no nose, no body, and so forth. And one might become quite puzzled in a sense that if, you know, the Buddha was next to a dying person and, you know, wanted to help the dying person, there might have been a different advice that the person could have gotten. But rather than giving that advice, the Buddha said there is no eye, no ear, no nose, and so forth. And Geshe said that when you think about what the Buddha did, what it indicates, one will have that great fear of death to a certain degree that accords with grasping at a self. The greater the degree of grasping at a self, grasping as if at myself as if I exist from my own side, the fear of death will become stronger and stronger. So that in thinking of the import of what the Buddha recited, there is no eye, no ear, no nose, and so forth, when one comes to understand that that there is no self as established in a way that it appears to our mind, when one will come to see the absence of the self, there's a great sense of ease and comfort that will dwell in one's mind. So we speak a lot about selflessness, the absence of the self, but it is definitely not an easy thing to understand. But you guys are interested in these teachings, right? So you came here seeking teachings. You come here to study in stages, the stages of the path that lead to enlightenment. So you take teachings, and then you ask questions. You have conversations with your peers and with others about those teachings. And through that graduated approach, an understanding of selflessness will be developed in your mind. So at some point, you will come to understand selflessness. But also, it's important to say that simply studying this material and thinking about it alone will not be enough. You also need to have the support of merit, because without having the support of the accumulation of merit, even if you're really smart, in the sense that even if you're a genius, without the accumulation of merit, you will not be able to form an understanding of selflessness. So, you know, we might be considered someone that in a very conventional term is considered to be totally smart, like a genius, but still, without having enough merit, they will not be able to form an understanding of selflessness. So our approach, therefore, should be such that we spend some time in accumulating merit, we study, we increase our understanding, and there's a real benefit that will come from that.
Some of the courts, then you would
So then, in looking at the sense of the path of the medium scope, the sense of the path of the medium scope involve also in understanding the will of life, the will of life in terms of the 12 links of dependent arising. So there is a reverse order to the 12 links of dependent arising, and there is a forward order of the 12 links of dependent arising. And nowadays we have a drawing, a picture of the will of life, right? So within that drawing of the will of life, you can also see this painting of the forward order of the 12 links of dependent arising, and you can also through that see the reverse order of the 12 links of dependent arising. There is a story that is taken from the life of the Buddha involving King Surabhipadra and his friend King Udayana. So one day King Surabhipadra got a present, or you know, a message and a present from King Udayana, and you know, he was wondering what would be the way to reciprocate the present of King Udayana. So he asked the Buddha, and the Buddha advised him to send King Udayana a painting, a drawing of the wheel of life that denotes the 12 links of dependent arising.
Si consultò con Suceni, poi gli chiese cosa posso portare al Cinico, disse su che era molto vicino a Suceni, ma chiediamolo a Bhagavan, quindi il Bhagavan che cosa potrebbe essere il beneficio. Il Bhagavan commissionò questo tipo di questo dipinto appunto perché potesse essere portato alla vista di questo nostro.
So then it is said that when the present was carried to King Udayana, you know, with the drawing of the 12 links of dependent arising, it was carried to that king, and you know, the tanka was unfurled and it was presented to him, and he was totally inspired by this drawing of the wheel of life. He said that, "I haven't met a spiritual teacher in this life, but I've certainly accumulated merit in my previous lifetimes." It is said that it depends upon seeing the tanka, he was able then to develop an understanding of the 16 aspects of the four truths, such as the aspect of impermanence. And on that basis, at the end, he was able to attain the state of an arhat. So when you think of this story and what this story symbolizes, it is possible that because of an accumulation of merit in previous lifetime, those imprints from past lifetimes will be activated, will be accessed in this lifetime, so that one would be able to make a great progress, a great leap, so to speak, in this lifetime. But then if we expect that that will happen to us as well, Geshe says that our approach should be to first of all begin with study, then reflection, and then meditation, rather than to expect that, you know, that will happen to us. It is possible that for some of us that have accumulated merit before, things will be accomplished in an easier way. But rather than thinking that will also happen to me, it is best to then take a graduated approach, to spend some time studying to begin with, then reflecting upon what we study, then meditation, so that our progression will be made easy.
Yeah.
So then, after that, someone noticed this tradition of painting the Wheel of Life at the entrance to a Tsuklakan, the main assembly hall of a certain monastery. And there's also a story that was involved with that about Gelong, the Fulio Den monk, that was taking someone around during one of the special days and was explaining the teachings of the Buddha on the basis of the painting of the Wheel of Life. So nowadays, this depiction of the Wheel of Life is found at the entrance to, you could say, most monasteries, great many monasteries in Tibet, or Tibetan monasteries in general. Together with that, you might come across another type of drawing, which is a drawing of the stages by which one attains shamatha, karma abiding. So you might have seen that before. There is a winding path, and there is an elephant that walks along that path together with a monk, a fully ordained monk, and there are no things happen to them, they change colors and so forth along this winding path. That denotes the stage of progression of karma abiding. So Geshe said that he hasn't seen those drawings here, but it is likely that you guys also have it here at Lamantung Kapa Institute. Anyway, after that, Geshe recited a verse, and I'm not familiar totally with the verse. I can probably get a copy of that later on. Geshe recommended reciting this verse. The gist of that verse is saying that a suffering arises from anger and attachment, those afflictive states of mind, and the actions that we take on that basis. And that comes into a state of quiescence once we understand emptiness. So I will get the verse later on and make it available to you, because Geshe said that if you think of this verse, and this verse was also recited by His Honest the Dalai Lama in the teaching that he gave at Ladakh, this verse encompasses the meaning of selflessness. So then if you recite that and you also think about the meaning of selflessness, alright, so this is the verse. So Geshe said that through the exhaustion of karma and afflictions, one will become liberated, right? Through the exhaustions of karma and afflictions, one will become liberated. That's the first part of the verse. So continuing with what Geshe said there, so there are different subtleties, different levels to selflessness. So we speak about, for example, selflessness in the sense of being empty, of being permanent, unitary, and independent. Selflessness of being empty, of being self-sufficient, substantially existent. We sometimes speak of selflessness in a sense of not existing truly, not existing from one's own side. And each one of those levels have a certain import, a certain significance that we can develop in our minds. So that when we go through those different levels from the coarse to the subtle, and we develop a better and better understanding of them, our mind gradually becomes more at ease, and our behavior also follows suit. It becomes a good behavior, a well-mannered behavior. So then, if you are able to do that, and you have a certain task, a certain work to fulfill in human society, even though you might be even a politician, you can do such a good work. You can be a good person, a well-mannered person. Even if you're a politician, if you think of how that self doesn't exist in that way, your mind can become vast and extensive. Your mind can become really spacious, and your behavior would be very well if you develop an understanding of the absence of the self, selflessness.
Che produrrà meglio, lavorerà meglio, avrà un rapporto migliore con gli altri, una mentalità molto più vasta, per cui sono dei grandi benefici. No, adesso.
Non temo, da me vorrebbe non c'è, perché tutti stanno, ma tu dai con noi, no? Se le maggiori, già quali scelte, siamo stati un giorno, insomma, da appena due sedi, per una ingegnere, dove c'è un giorno, c'è lo stanno, l'ogni scelta, l'anzi, l'avrà dovuto, come dicevano qualsiasi. Però da tenere il mio buon prezzo, mi sembra una cosa, delle mamme tanto è che tengo io a roba, cioè tanto tanto lì, sembrare voce in cena, in scena, tanto in questo, e me ne, con il mio cagliere mai, ma te ne fai io ciò, io ho detto che vede io a roba, che siamo diretti.
Now, our attitude should be a long-term attitude in that you might study the topic of selflessness, but it's not that straight off, right away, you will come to understand it. Now, if you have that expectation that that will quickly occur, it is likely that that will not happen. When you think about it, now, if you were to get a certain certification of being an engineer or being a doctor, you need to study for quite a few years. If you think about the number of years that you have to study altogether from not going to school, it would be more than 20 years or 20 odd years, right? So even more so when you think of attending the state of liberation or the state of enlightenment, which I think that requires even more than being an engineer, more than being a doctor. So then, taking that into consideration, our attitude should be a long-term attitude. Now, we need to set objectives, and the objective should be a long-term objective. And also we should not be fickle in that it's not that we should be haphazard about what we're doing. No, one day do one thing, then following, then change it, and then take up something else and leave it half done. Our attitude should be persistent and consistent in having long-term goals.
Lassa.
So obviously things did not happen in a way that Geshe-la intended to. It's now 10 past 11, so Geshe-la will continue with the presentation of the session of the Path of the Great Scope tomorrow, and in the time that we still have left for this session, if you guys have any questions, Geshe-la will now take some questions up and give further explanation.
E io quelle domande fatte in italiano dovrò ripetere in inglese per il nostro collega Monaco.
E qua in Occidente le persone comuni che si avvicinano al Dharma ascoltano insegnamenti di diverse scuole, questo è molto facile che succeda. Scuole per cui, appunto come nella nostra scuola tibetana, la pratica è fondata sull'accettazione delle rinascite, e scuole in cui la pratica è proprio fondata sulla negazione delle rinascite. Quindi le persone fanno spesso confusione. Allora io chiedo questo: è possibile indicare basi valide di imputazione della realtà delle rinascite usando argomenti che non siano quelli della visione chiaroveggente dei saggi e dei maestri e neanche quello della continuità della mente istante per istante, cioè eliminando queste due spiegazioni che sono quelle che noi normalmente diamo e che per alcuni sono ancora più difficili da accettare le rinascite, quindi eliminando la visione chiaroveggente, eliminando l'argomento della visione chiaroveggente, eliminando l'argomento della continuità istante per istante, com'è possibile indicare le rinascite come base valida di imputazione?
Penso che grandi pichetto la sumba in angadi se ngadi inchetto la ngadi inchetto la dende di gran lagi lagi na inchetto lagi.
So the question was, in the West, most people are not Buddhist, and therefore they don't think much of past and future lives. No, it's really difficult to think of past and future life. So normally, in order to prove that past and future life tends to exist, we use logic, right? Like, for example, the continuous of consciousness. Geshe-la says that, recited some arguments from the Pramanavartika. So there are a few arguments for that. There are some other arguments, such as, for example, those who have clairvoyance that can see past and future lifetimes. However, sometimes, in thinking of the arguments that are found in the Pramanavartika, in the continuum of consciousness, those that have clairvoyance that can see past and future lifetimes, it's still quite difficult to use them in order to prove that past and future lifetimes do exist. Are there any arguments that are easier than that, that we can use in order to prove the existence of past and future lifetimes? Well, I guess I said that if we expect something that is easier than that, no, it might be a bit lazy on our account. Well, first of all, we need to recognize that the existence of past and future lifetime is a hidden phenomenon. And since it's a hidden phenomenon, it's not going to be something that will be that we'll understand readily or easily. Right? It is a hidden phenomenon. And there is a great discussion that has occurred before in India between scholars such as Dharmakirti in his Pramanavartika, in which he debated different scholars, including those that come from non-Buddhist traditions. And some of the debates were surrounding whether past and future lifetimes do exist. No, so of course there were those argumentation that were involved with, if one has clairvoyance that can see past and future lifetime, then that can be used in order to demonstrate, or in order to prove that past lifetime do exist. No, those arguments become quite complicated. There's a story about one of those person that said that, I remember that I was, I died in that particular state or in that place, and I took rebirth in that place. So such story came up in the writing of Dharmakirti in relation to the existence of past and future lifetime. But anyway, if we expect that there is something other than that that could prove it, it's going to be a little bit difficult, particularly considering the fact that looking at our current culture and environment, particularly here in Italy or in our surrounding, we grew up in a place that asserts or that supports a creator God. So it's going to be even more difficult for us to come to see the existence of past and future lifetimes. It's in no way going to be easier for us to understand the existence of past and future lifetimes. So our attitude should be based on a certain research that is similar to how you're going to do it from a scientific perspective. So if you're a scientist and you're examining a particular phenomenon, and Geshe took something in his glasses case and held it in his hand, so as a scientist, you will be looking at that and you will investigate the continuum of matter. Now you will investigate the matter in sense of its continuum, and try to trace it back to the source. So then we base it on the continuum of consciousness. So in the same way that our body has a continuum of substance, also our mind has a continuum. So when we think of, for example, what we remember today, is based upon a consciousness that we had yesterday. So we can prove a continuity of consciousness. It depends upon recollecting or remembering something that occurred to us yesterday or the day before. So this is in relation to the continuum of consciousness.
Yesterday, when we go to Hermes and when we practice Buddhism, we have to be non-partisan and non-biased. And so I'm not sure about, I don't quite understand this. Does it mean, how is it when someone is being partisan and biased? Does it mean that he breaks off his self?
Does it mean that what do you say at the end?
Does it mean being a partisan and biased when practicing Buddhism? Does it mean that he grades off the self? I don't understand what this is when Ling Rinpoche mentions non-partisan.
Okay. Allora ieri Italy detto la città pubblica. Ieri a Paradiso ci ha parlato dell'importanza di approcciare lo studio della pratica buddista con una mente che è imparziale, che non ha dei pregiudiziali, nel cercare di comprendere e di vedere. Non capisco bene che cosa vuol dire questa cosa. Nel caso di Lome ci Mare. Certo para tossamo sulla soprattutto di ciò rimedio ci vuole dosso non c'è rimedio ciò rimedio di sempre casse che dosso di dove carne vesa
no era una cosa una buona routine ma lì è scontato che sembra che la mare è sempre di ciò sotto
no
perché sono in mare
No.
Well, to be non-biased, non-partisan in relation to the teachings of the Buddha, for example, for us as Buddhists. Now, if you see yourself as Buddhist, you might be thinking that, of course, the teachings of the Buddha are true, and what others have said in other traditions is not true. Such an attitude is a biased attitude. No, this is an attitude of being partisan. So for us as Buddhists, even though if we're Buddhists, we will develop a certain attitude with respect to the teachings and investigating them, right? So we'll take up the teachings of the Buddha. We will check whether they are correct, whether they're incorrect. After all, even within the teaching, you find certain statements that something is like this, and then you find out, you get other statements that say that it is like that, right? So you need to take them up without swaying to either direction, you know, in a sense that, you know, you hear a certain explanation, you know, about something that is good, and then you sway to that direction. You know, you hear the same teaching that, you know, in something they say that it is bad, and you sway to the either direction. So without kind of being subject to the sense of bias, you take up something and you examine for yourself whether it is correct or whether it is incorrect.
Qualcun altro? Ecco qua, Raffaello.
Ieri Rinpoche, quando è arrivato alla terza strofa del testo, parlava della madre dei conquistatori, e diceva che nel testo precedente invece si parlava di un...
In un testo pubblicato a Gandhi, di una versione pubblicata a Gandhi.
Parlava invece di un'altra cosa che era più pervasiva. Volevo un po' più di scienza.
Raffaello, invece...
Yesterday, Rinpoche. Spoke about the verses in the prologue, and he spoke about the mother of the conquerors, right? So there is a reference to the mother of the conquerors in something from Ganden. Anyway, the point is clarifying that. All right, so there is a point here of contention with respect to scriptural systems that came from Ganden Monastery and another monastery. Apparently there is some discrepancy between the textual systems, the texts that those monasteries use. The ones that came from the Ganden tradition, speaking about what is the mother of the conquerors, what is this textual system, includes those sutras of the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, the one that also were explained by the masters, the two trailblazers. In essence, Geshe-la said that here the point of contention with respect to understanding what is that mother of the conquerors is based on the differences in the printing or the actual text, the teachings that the Buddha gave and the commentaries that were composed by the great masters with respect to differences in the scriptural texts. Scriptural systems. What made it to the scriptural systems, as is found in the Ganden Monastery and another monastery as well.
Per cortesia, vorrei veramente sapere da dove viene il potere del mantra. Il potere del mantra. Ok. Di ma in un pacare di uno sa.
The question is, the question.
So the question was about the power of mantra. So one might wonder, where does the power, the efficacy of mantra comes from? Also in the Hindu tradition, not in the Buddhist tradition, but also in the Hindu tradition, there is a great use of mantra, and there's a lot of explanation of the power of mantra that is coming also from Hindu sources. Mantras are not used only in the Vajrayana, they're also used in the Paramitayana, the perfection system, so that when you look at the references to the uses of mantra in the perfection system, you find that there's a reference to certain, what is called dharani, which are certain mantra strings that are used, right? They're called dharani, not dharani of speech, and not this dharani and the other dharani. It is said that in order to protect others from fear, for example, you can use a certain dharani, a certain mantra. So this is not only found in the Vajrayana, which explains different mantras according to different classes of tantra, but it's also found in the perfection system, which means that when you get to a certain mental development and your mind is moved by a certain set of motivation, you can use a mantra, a dharani, in certain cases, such as protecting others from fear. So that depends upon the power of the mind, right? The power of the mantra is dependent upon the power of the mind. And in order to illustrate it, Geshe-la gave an example, and he said, I don't know, it's probably happening here in Italy. I'm not too familiar with that. So let's go with that and see if that's the case. Suppose that you want to build a new house, a new building. It might be that there is another person that dislikes you, that is envious of you. No, they will have a certain certain malicious intent against you. So, no, the mind in some sense has the power to project a certain thing, a certain form, a certain thing that might disturb or that might, you know, cause some problems to your plans. No, and there might be also ways to avert that. Anyway, Geshe-la said that the power of mantra has to do essentially with the power of one's mind.
È stato detto che praticando l'etica dell'evitare le distorsioni negative c'è certezza che poi si rinasca come essere umano, quindi si abbia una rinascita corporale. Però nella Visamana Ankara c'è scritto che fin tanto che non si raggiunge il livello tolleranza del sentiero della preparazione, c'è sempre il pericolo di cadere in una rinascita sfortunata nei reami inferiori. Quindi sembra che praticando solo le distorsioni negative evitare le decisioni negative, praticare l'etica di evitare le decisioni negative, secondo la Samana non c'è certezza poi di avere per forza una rinascita fortunata, no? Sembra che c'è una contraddizione. Se diciamo per cortesia può spiegare questo fatto, grazie.
Certo, per chiarire quello che è stato detto precisamente, che sulla base delle decisioni, nella parte della volontà delle decisioni virtuose, di sicuro ottiene una rinascita umana. Quello è stato detto, non che quello vuol dire che allora non avrai mai per rinascita interiore.
No, però la domanda, cioè, siccome è stato detto che di sicuro,
quello di sicuro porta come risultato una
rinascita. Ok, però nella tua domanda c'è scritto che se non si raggiunge il livello di tolleranza, sempre la prevenzione, c'è sempre il rischio di cadere. Quindi sembra anche dire che, anzi, se pratichi solo queste levitare decisioni negative, puoi sempre ricadere nella circostanza, certo. se non raggiungi il livello di tolleranza. Questo sembra dire la
cosa. Con adesso che tu farci in anno la.
In the perfection system, in the Abhisamaya Alankara, ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 non-virtuous actions, one can attain a rebirth such as a human rebirth. But in the context of the Abhisamaya Alankara, along the path of preparation, so the doubt here is whether it is sufficient just to abstain from non-virtues in order to attain a pleasurable rebirth, a higher rebirth. That is referred to something. So there are four stages to the path of preparation: pick, so heat, pick, forbearance, and supreme, and then quality. Okay, so the question is with respect to a point that came up before. It was said that if you cultivate the ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 non-virtuous actions, it is certain that you will attain a pleasant state of existence as a human being and so forth. However, when you look at the way that the states of the path are explained in the perfection system, in the Abhisamaya Alankara, the path of preparation is divided into four parts. So you have pick, heat, pick, forbearance, and supreme, and then quality. It is said that when you attain the third part of the path of preparation, the path of forbearance, you are guaranteed, it is certain that you will no longer fall into a miserable state of existence. So then you will not take a miserable rebirth. So that being the case, it implies that that can exist before that. So then when you think about it in case of bodhisattvas, you have bodhisattvas on the path of accumulation, bodhisattvas on the path of preparation. These bodhisattvas are ordinary sentient beings, which means that taking a miserable rebirth exists also for them in certain situations, right? So they can be even bodhisattvas, and yet they can take a miserable rebirth before attaining the forbearance part of the path of preparation. So then when you think of when one has the certainty that the doors to the invisible realms are completely closed, well, this is something that you get when you attain a true cessation. So here we can speak about true cessations and non-analytical cessations. Geshe-la didn't get into all the, he said that we're not going to get into those details now. But then the question is, if when you're a bodhisattva on the path of accumulation or the path of preparation along certain stages, you can take a miserable rebirth, that occurs due to the power of non-virtue. So Geshe-la said to that, indeed, even Chandrakirti referred to that in his supplement to the Middle Way. In one of the verses he said that the accumulation of virtue that was accumulated through hundreds of eons or thousands of eons of practicing generosity and so forth will be destroyed by a moment of anger. No. Of course, you can say that, you know, what he said with respect to bodhisattvas that take a miserable rebirth in one of the three miserable states of existence, for them it would be like a bouncing of a ball. No, it wouldn't be like us staying in that state for a long time. It would be like throwing a ball on the ground and the ball bouncing up again straight off. From them, a miserable rebirth would be just like that. So there is a certain story involved with Ralo Tsawa. I'm not familiar with all the details, but it is said that Ralo Tsawa has completed the generation stage of High Sukha Tantra. No, and also, no, in relation to that, there were accounts by Ralo Tsawa, those beings that were bodhisattvas, and they attend a miserable rebirth and bounce back from that straight off like a bouncing ball.
Con i suoi poteri uccise 13 bodhisattva, 13 bodhisattva, e per quella ragione viene citato come esempio che anche lo fece per il beneficio degli esseri.
Since Fabrizio is more familiar with that story, he's probably telling more details in that story. Guess I told it just in short. So it seems that our time is up for today, but probably one more question.
Volevo sapere che importanza ha la memoria nel miglioramento della propria esistenza, della persona.
Di circa essere tutti, tagliati di, ora di tempo con sempre io, no? Sempre di sosso avanti ci ha di semi, di arutai alla tempo a semi di che c'è su.
The question is whether one can be able to develop one's mind or consciousness using mindfulness. So mindfulness indeed is very important. When you look at the 37 aspects that are also explained in the Abhisamayalamkara, they are divided into different groups, beginning with the group of the four close placement of mindfulness. Now within that you have other groups, like for example the four correct abandoners and so forth. Anyway, The first group of factors are the four close placement of mindfulness. So we have mindfulness of body, mindfulness of mind, and so forth, and mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mind, and so forth. So you start with the practice of mindfulness, which becomes very important. For when we think of other practices that we take up, we need to make the mind adhere to a certain object of meditation, and that is facilitated through mindfulness. Particularly when you think about it in the context of developing shamatha, developing calm abiding, without developing that faculty of mindfulness, you will not be able to develop calm abiding shamatha. And therefore, you employ not only mindfulness, you also need to employ vigilance. This is to say, you need to have mindfulness and alertness, and you also need other things to come through, to come in between. You need to have effort, and you need to have wisdom, and you need to have concentration. Now, the word for mindfulness in Tibetan is chenpa, which is also used for remembering or recollecting, which carries on a similar connotation. So, for example, Geshe-la said that we might begin a morning with doing our morning meditation, morning recitations. We might take up different recitations, and then when we finish with that and go out and do whatever we need to do throughout the day, if we do not sustain that mindfulness, that sense of recollection, we will end up becoming involved with those activities that we shouldn't get involved with, particularly if we see ourselves as Buddhists, right? So if, for example, you go out during the day and you develop the mindfulness, this is to say recollection of the Buddha, it would be helpful in terms of reminding you what type of actions you need to abstain from, what type of actions you want to take up. Now, what is the type of behavior that you want to take up as Buddhist? If you are mindful of the Buddha, if you recollect the Buddha, that would be helpful. It is for the same reason, for example, if you're a monk, you know, you can say that often, if you're a monk or if you're a nun, when you wear the robes, you're able to better recollect what you ought to do as a monk. If you don't wear the robes, then there is a danger that you will not recollect being a monk or being a monastic, and then end up behaving in a way that is in a way that will promote all the adversities or all the different things, all the negative things that you need to abstain from. No, so monastics have those special robes or special clothing for the sake of making them remember that they took up a certain ethical conduct and they need to abide by it. So there's this term, the four close placements of mindfulness, are found in scripture. So in one context, they're applied to a certain progression along the steps of the path. So the initial stage of the path, and I'm adding to that, Geshe-la is probably referring to the first part of the path of accumulation, it is called the four close placements of mindfulness. But there is also an explanation of the mindfulnesses that are found in other texts that are explained separately.
Sangye shingdu mikte uwagi Joko namdak shinla che pashu Iram guru ranna mandala kam niyayatayami Ngevadi nyudu dang lama sangye rum yone Drowa chinkya malu padeye salage pashu Janchup sem chok rinpoche Makye panam gengyo chi Kepan yampa me payang Gone gondru pelwash